Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Just another warning, as I have been doing for the last few days, this programme, or the start of it at least, we've been contacted by a number of people who have been abused and had contact in other different ways with Father Joseph Marmion. He was the Jesuit priest. The Jesuits, last Tuesday, the Jesuit order in Ireland named him as a paedophile and a sexual abuser and physical abuser and mental abuser of children. They discovered this, they say, in 1977. And he died in the year 2000. A number of people have contacted us, said they discovered it in 1977. Why is he buried in the Jesuit plot in Glasnevin? Why did he get the full high mass in Gardiner Street Church for his funeral of those on the altar? Did those on the altar and those in attendance know the crimes this man had committed? And they are crimes. Some of them are heinous crimes. Now, the other thing, I don't know if the Jesuits were conscious of this, that when they released this man's name, they would in turn resurrect really difficult incidents for a lot of young people. That's no one's fault in that sense. But it also meant that some people would have to tell their families for the first time because of questions asked about Marmion and how they sexually abused him. And one such person, student of the Crescent College in Limerick, the other thing as well is this guy, Marmion, was rampant. He was on the prowl in Clongowes in the 60s, Belvedere in the 70s, the Crescent, all Jesuit schools, by the way, in the 80s. Then in St. Vincent's Hospital, he worked, even after he was exposed as a paedophile, he was removed from the school and moved around the corner, by the way, to Gardiner Street Church. Then he worked, then he got a year in Paris. Then he got, he was brought back to Gardiner Street. Then he was sent out as chaplain to St. Vincent's Hospital. And all the while, the Jesuits order, according to their own statement last week, knew he was a paedophile. And if the allegations which we heard on Friday were the ones that prompted, and it does seem so, what prompted the Jesuits to eventually move in 1977 against him, they are of such a serious criminal nature. The boys being drugged and raped while they were on a trip to Austria with Marmion as the only adult in the group from Belvedere College, that nobody could stand idly by. Now, the first contribution today comes from one such person who only told his family at the weekend that he had been abused. He's obviously now in a good age, 50s or 60s. And this is the letter. We've been speaking to the man, and this is what he wants us, what he's written for us to read out.
Dear Joe, in 1969, Father Joseph Marmion sexually abused me in Crescent College in Limerick. I was 12 years of age. My father brought me to the Crescent on a Sunday to do a costume check for the opera, A Night in Venice. It was in a hall with costume rails around us. It's sad to think my dad was unknowingly delivering me to this abuser that day. I remember having to undress. He had me sitting on his lap. I had to put on tights and sponges tucked on the sides of my underpants, I think to show I was a woman, as I was a soprano in the opera. I didn't tell my parents what happened. I knew it was wrong. I was moved by my parents to another school within a few months. I always thought that I was moved because they knew what happened. I thought maybe I was at fault. I am a reasonably robust person, but I believe I suffered from what was my, unfortunately, first sexual experience. I was in shock, startled to hear Luke had exactly the same experience as I had. It brought back the memories very vividly. I think Luke said it happened to him in 1977. So in 1968-69 it happened to me. Therefore Marmion was sexually abusing students over a longer period. It's difficult to believe he wasn't found out over this long period. I would like to know why he was moved from Crescent, I believe in 1969. Was he discovered and not reported? Anonymous.
Okay, and as I say, that's been verified from a young 12-year-old who was in the Crescent in Limerick, a Jesuit school, in 1969. It was 1977, according to the Jesuit statement. Well, they discovered and moved, didn't really move. They discovered that in September that he there was serious allegations being made. And remember, the Jesuits have said categorically, they're making public the name of a former teacher and priest, Joseph Marmion, S.J., who abused boys sexually, emotionally and physically. There's no ifs or buts. Barry Collins. Barry, good afternoon. Joe at RT.ie. Marmion taught you French for 3 years in Belvedere.
Hi, Joe. Jenny. Yeah, it was actually 4 years.
Okay.
I left in 75 and I wasn't the subject, or rather the object of his affections, in that I managed to avoid all difficulties with them. I did something maybe slightly unusual or contradictory. I maybe with a sense of survivor instinct, I actually decided to go into the opera because I thought it would make my life easier in French class. So whereas I know some of my pals deliberately, when they were being auditioned, they missed their notes. I can't remember being auditioned, but I was in three operas, and I was left alone. But there were certainly, he was everything that the people described, the boys described last week. He was a vicious sadist. He was an evil man, and he certainly, I'm haunted by the fact that there was one chap in our year, in my class, rather French class, who was a very bright guy, who was a very good singer. He was a soloist, and Marmion, I've no doubt, listening to what I've listened to over the last few days, he groomed him. We at that age, I think we thought we knew it all, but in fact, you know, I didn't even know what the word groom meant. I thought it was something to do with horses. Mm-hmm. But Marmion used to sit on the wall of these. There's a wall at Belvedere House at breaks, and yeah. I think ostensibly to supervise the breaks. And he would be surrounded by what we used to call his pets. Licks was another word we had for them, and this particular guy was generally sitting beside him. So unfortunately we took a dislike to this guy because he just the teacher's pet, but he hasn't been seen since we left school, and the rumour has it that he's passed, and I fear that Marmion, from the stories I've heard from Luke and just what you've read out there, that he suffered the same way as those other pupils did.
And when you say he was a sadist, why do you come to that conclusion, Barry?
Everything that you said, he picked on another guy in the class who he disliked, and he would turn us on him, and the go get him, I think you heard that. We would all get out of our seats, run down to the back of the class and beat the living daylights out of him. Unfortunately, now thinking about it and thinking obviously we shouldn't have done it, but we were only 12, 13, and Marmion used to sit there and he enjoyed it. He also did the other instances of punishment where you would stand on the blackboard, face the blackboard, and push your face up against it, so the mark would be there of your nose, and then he would draw the circle about 3 or 4 inches above that mark, and you'd have to stand on your tiptoes and put your nose into that mark, and for as long as... So obviously, you could do it for a few minutes, but you couldn't do it, I can't recall what happened then afterwards.
And Barry, we also had stories... There seem to be a number of occasions, a number of different callers have told us that at times he encouraged boys to gang up on another boy.
Well, that's what I just described.
Oh, yeah, that's what you described? Okay, sorry.
He would sit at the top at the desk.
Okay.
They were the old two-seater desks.
Right.
He'd sit and put his feet, he'd face the class, back to the blackboard.
Okay.
And he'd effectively lecture to us. And then if the individual was doing something or was distracted, or if he just got a notion, he'd just say, go get him. and it was the same guy all the time.
And who would go get him? The other,
the whole class would. We thought it was a bit of fun. It killed a few minutes of the class, and sure.
And what did go get him result in?
Running back to the back of the class and basically punching him. And indeed, if you couldn't get at the individual, you'd just give the fellow in front of you a belt. It was a free for all, and we thought it was a hoot.
And this was instigated by Marmion.
By Marmion, yeah. It saved him. If he was particularly vile humour, he would go around, and he was a big man. He did have hands the size of hams, and he would punch you in. He'd punch in the arm, and that soft muscle part. He would pull your hair at just around your ears. We were terrified of him.
And did you hear that he? And wasn't there one description still of a chap being beaten up by Marmion's instigation by his fellow pupils? And he said, his buddy said his face was as if he'd been in a car crash.
What I recall hearing once that it stopped when there was a fracture, somebody broke an arm or a wrist or something, possibly after beating him, and then the word would come back that something happened in another class. You see, we thought it was all happening in our class. We didn't realise he was out. You didn't talk about this.
And he was doing it not just in Belvedere, he was doing it in other schools as well, previously and subsequently, it seems.
Yes, so I've heard all that. I mean, the pattern is there, as I said. We thought it was just us. And, I mean, Belvedere was a very... It was an austere place. There was an arrogance about the place. If you like, a superiority complex. That was amongst mainly the Jesuits. I don't think the boys, I hope the boys didn't maybe seep down, but it was very old school, even the names of the classes, rhetoric, poetry. We didn't have 60 or 50 of grammar. We had grammar and syntax.
Oh, yeah.
The place was up itself, I have to say, back then. I don't believe it's like that now. But I sent my three boys to Belvedere, so from that point of view, I think that's we have Father Leonard Maloney. He was the headmaster at the time, and he's now has the unfortunate job as the provincial to try and sort this mess out. Now, if anyone could do it, it will be him, because I've huge time for him, and he did fantastic things for the school.
But there's still a lot of unanswered questions, and
wasn't there. My problem really is, and it came up on Friday, a chap called Shane Slattery phoned in, and who was humiliated by Marmion, and he sought him out and
stood up to him,
and I thought, it took a boy to do it. He then got expelled, or technically expelled, and then it was a petition that got him back. And so that told me that there were some senior Jesuits in Belvedere at the time, there were some senior teachers, and they did nothing. They turned the other way and left us to this monster. Mm.
Stay with us, Barry, Joe at RT.ie, Frank in Donegal. Frank, I know you're saying I'm not a victim and I don't want to be represented as such, but what did you witness in Crescent College at the hands of Marmion?
Hi, Joe. I was in the Crescent from 1959 Crescent in Limerick, right through from 1959 right through to 1970. So I went through both the junior school, as it then was, and then the secondary school. And, he was a pretty... He was a pretty menacing guy, to say the least of it. Mm-hmm. But I do remember some. Let your last speaker there talked about the guys who used to suck up to him, and that, you know, actually he had a number of us that he used to call. We were his MFPs. MFP stood for my favorite pupil. And if you were one of his MFPs, you didn't tend to get hit or bothered or beaten up so much by him. But if you weren't one of his MFPs, it could be open season, and you're depending on his mood. And I do remember one incident particularly, because it always stood out all my life, all these years. We were in the class, I think we were in fifth year at the time, and he launched into this guy. I won't mention his name now, I can still remember his name, but he really gave him a terrible hammering. He pulled at his hair, pulled him around the head, and pulled him away from the desk and along the floor in the classroom. And it really was terrifying. Now, this guy really really turned on him then and said like he was going to tell his father on him, and then Marmion just laughed that off. But it was quite a terrifying experience for a class of 25 kids to look at, you know.
And was it the same in the Crescent? Was he involved in the music? Was he involved in German? Did he organise a trip every year to Vienna?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. He taught me English and German. And actually, the irony is he was a relatively good teacher. I still have good German after all these years, okay, even though I haven't been in Germany for years and years. But I was in the operetta. I remember that the year we did it was in 68, 69. I think Christmas, New Year, 68, 69. We did a night in Venice. I think was the name of Johann Strauss operetta. And I remember having a part in that. I don't know that I volunteered, but I can't remember at the time. But I was picked anyway. And but like that too. Like as other people have said, I mean, he would. One of the things, I mean, my own experience was he you know, we had to try on the costume as well. Yeah. And like I was taken to a basement room and he would try on these, you try on this and try on this. And I said, fine. And then he produced the tights and you have to wear these. And I kind of just looked at him and said, look, I'll tell your father there's two chances of my wearing tights on the stage and they both end in all. So I wouldn't do it, but like, and he kind of left it at that then, so I didn't. I got to wear a normal pair of trousers, something like that, with the uniform. So, but I mean, it was years later when I actually recalled that incident, and it was years later I recalled that incident, maybe 20, 25 years later after I'd left school, and I recalled that incident to mind one day, I don't know how, and then I kind of clicked and said, God, that's what he was at then. You know, that's what motivation.
Let me bring Neil in. Stay there, Frank, please, and then go. Neil, okay. You went to Belvedere.
Yeah, I was in Belvedere from 1973 to 1979, and like a lot of people of my generation, I now live outside Ireland.
Okay. And what are your memories of any of Marmion? And
well, this week has brought us all back. I mean, all of you've heard so many strange stories over the last week. It's all true. I have seen or heard at the time from multiple sources who spoke from their own direct experience. I mean, to be clear, I was never Marmion's direct victim myself, in that I was never the object of either violence or molestation.
Okay.
But like other speakers a few moments ago, I saw violence used against people, and I heard at the time from many people the stories of sexual perversion. So these were things which were common knowledge. You've talked, for example, I think in the last few days about these Vienna trips he organized. Well, I never went on those, but I heard the stories of the rectal thermometers. I never heard the story of drugging children for purposes of sex. He was supposed to like Vienna because of the opera, and he had a friend there called Karl. And maybe that's something for the Austrian police to look at. A speaker a moment ago said he was a good teacher of German. Well, I don't know if you've ever learned German, but it has many irregular verbs. And he taught them through terror, because basically if you made a mistake, something terrible would happen. When he taught us English, he made us read stuff or listen to stuff which was not remotely on the syllabus. So Samson Agonistes, the rape of the lock, and sonnets of Shakespeare, which he explained, were love poems written by Shakespeare to a man. So I think he was a better teacher of German than of English, because I still hate Pope and I hate Milton. Okay. The rest of us that you've heard in the last few days about the sadism, or letting us learn Erika, the song, or how he taught people to open their mouths when singing by putting their hands in their mouths. It's all true. I never thought the story would come out. I think we owe a great deal to Tom Dooherty and now to you on Liveline, because you've had the guts to actually cover this. If you look at the rest of the coverage in the Irish media this week, it's been almost nothing. The Irish Times, Fintan O'Toole, has had little or nothing to say. Tom Dooherty started the thing, and you've given it legs, and I think that you deserve great credit for this.
Well, it was Simon Carswell, I know, wrote a piece on Saturday. I know the Mail on Saturday had two more pages from Tom Dooherty, and they've been covering it every single day from either from Tom or from people who've been on this programme. I don't know what... anyway, newspapers aside, and they've different. Sometimes they're different and bigger stories. The silence from the, if I can just say to you all, the silence now, well, from the Jesuits is interesting, because we've put a number of questions to them about. They say categorically in their statement, this man was a paedophile and a criminal. It's a criminal is the word we should be looking at. And they knew about this, they say, in 1977, even though the letter that was voiced at the start of the programme was a sexual abuse in the Crescent in Limerick in 1968-69. That young boy, who was 12, said, I was moved by my parents to another school within a few months. I always thought that I was moved because they knew what happened. I thought maybe I was at fault. But even when the Jesuits do accept that in 1977 this man was a criminal, they took their time moving him from Belvedere. They took a full academic year. They never moved to, as far as we can find out, to expel him from the Jesuits. He continued as a working Jesuit. He was buried as a Jesuit. He's buried in the Jesuit plot in Glasnevin. We presume he was buried out of Gardiner Street. We presume there was somebody presided at that obsequies, and we're at the obsequies, and we're asking, did they know, if who knew that this man was a criminal for 23 years at least, 23 years at least before he died a full Jesuit? And that's
Joe, the,
Barry, yeah.
Frank
and Donegal, sorry,
yeah.
Frank.
Just to interspress it, just it was mentioned there about the trips to Vienna, and as I said, I was on the trip to Vienna with the class and Marmion in the autumn. I remember as well the early August 1969.
And Frank, was just to be clear, was Marmion the only adult in that?
You know, he was the only one that accompanied us from the school in Limerick. But
yeah,
Yeah. But we stayed, I think, as I recall, we stayed in some kind of a Jesuit seminary or something like that. So, you know, we there were other adults and Jesuit seminarians and all that around, you know, but certainly he took the group on his own. I don't recall any other. No, there was no other teacher with us.
Why not?
What was interesting though is that when we came back from that trip, I don't recall anything bad happening to me personally now the trip in Vienna. But I do remember actually rebelling against him once or twice on the trip. Though he probably peeved me off about something. But when we came back from the trip to Vienna around the middle or third week in August, we went back to school in September, fully expecting Marmion to be continuing or teaching us for our Leaving Cert year, and he was gone.
Mm.
He was just gone. He was suddenly moved to Belvedere, and then the rumours started spreading that he left under a cloud, but that was all we knew. But I mean, it was extraordinary that he was moved from the Crescent after only 5 years to Belvedere, just after we came back from that trip to Vienna in the autumn of 69. I often wondered about that since.
Yeah,
but,
okay, you know, that guy seemed to be part of his MO, as they say. Who wants Barry? Barry, can I ask you? Barry, you say you sent your three boys to Belvedere.
Hmm.
Marmion was gone, obviously.
Oh, he was well gone. I would have picked subjects when I was finally rid of him in fourth year. I think after the intro, you sit down and you pick your subjects for Leaving Cert. I would have chosen them very carefully. I wouldn't have nothing to do with that man. He was well gone. I think the place had sorted itself out a bit. And as I said, Father Leonard Maloney was running the place, and he did a brilliant job. It was a different school to the school that I was in. It was a much more pleasant place, and there was much more respect between the boys and the teachers. But you have to think back in the 70s, and you should remember that yourself, Joe. Things were different then. The religious pretty well ran the show. My parents were religious and would have whatever the priest says goes. That's the way it was then.
But as you say, Barry, you made the point that it was that chap was a John Stanley. Shane Stanley, wasn't
Shane
it?
Shane Slattery,
who actually, this was a student who stood up to him.
Absolutely, it's the only one. And in fact, even if you go back to one of the worst pieces to come out of this was the drugging of the boy in Vienna. Again, I think it was the boys themselves who came out and did something about it. We needed help, and we didn't get it. There were some senior Jesuits there at the time, and there were some senior teachers. And where were they when all this was going on?
Yeah, I'd have to echo that thinking. I mean, certainly in the Crescent in the 60s, mid to late 60s, right. I mean, I personally feel that many other Jesuits knew, or many other people in that school knew about that guy's carry on, at very least for the physical violence, because that was all over the place. And, I hold all of those as accessories after the effect to this, by virtue of the fact that they kept silence and didn't move against him.
Well, another contact.
But they had a small thing about the way it came out. The story came out in 1977.
We believe that the caller we had on Friday, again, we were using, we know their full names, but we were using a different name. I don't want to get confused on the names. But he is the chap. He is the one who went to the Jesuit order in 4 or 5 years ago saying, you must name this man. You must name this man. And they knew the name, obviously, but he wanted them to name him publicly to try and help other people deal with the issues. That they'd raised. But we've another email here. Again, people are, for reasons that will become obvious, want to maintain not just their name anonymity, but their voice anonymity as well. The statement released by the Irish Province of Jesuits on March the 2nd last year, it raises some questions, more questions than it answers. For instance, what supervision, if any, of Marmion was in place from 1977 to his death in the year 2000. Where did he reside during those years? Did he reside continuously in Gardiner Street? Who knew what and when? Was he subjected to a canonical trial? And if not, why not? Were his fellow Jesuits made aware of his crimes? The Jesuits say subsequent appointments should not have been made. Were other mistakes made? Did he have any engagement with or access to students in any other schools? In 2019, all Jesuit provinces in North America had published lists of known Jesuit abusers going back to the 1950s. As of this week, 2nd of the 3rd, 21, the Irish province for the first time has published the name of one Jesuit abuser. 2 decades after his death and circa 50 years since the abuse was first disclosed to them. Key questions arise. Will the Irish Jesuits now honour a new spirit of transparency and reconciliation and publish a full list of Irish Jesuit abusers? Will the Irish Jesuits now rescind any gag orders, or NDAs as they're known, non-disclosure agreements imposed on survivors as part of their settlements? The Church has regularly used such means to silence survivors. Please do not use my name, but I'm happy to speak to a researcher, which is what happened. So there's, as I say, there's more questions than answers at this stage, and we've asked all those questions of the Jesuits in writing, and we're trying to get them on the phone, but the phone seemed to be ringing out for the last few days. Okay, Frank in Donegal, Barry Collins, thanks indeed, and Neil, go to Mahogod. 51551, Marchand.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
The reason we're putting a representative number of calls up, we're not putting them all up, about the vaccine is for information purposes, and it's not for blaming anybody. I take that point very strongly. But it's for information purposes, for our listeners and also for the powers that be. Maybe they do coincide at times. Leah Cooney. Leah, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you today?
Good, thanks. And how are you? Who is it that's waiting on the vaccine?
My lovely grandmother is awaiting on a vaccine, and I've been trying to reach out just for a little bit of help or a resolution to the state that we're in at the moment. She's 98 years of age, and she's still awaiting her vaccine. The reason she's still waiting for her vaccine is because she is housebound. She lives with her husband, also 98, and they're a wonderful pair. I'm a very proud granddaughter, and I suppose I'm just reaching out for a little bit of help. I'm getting no answers from any TDs or health ministers, and again, as you just said it there at the start, I'm not here to point blame or to give out, really. I just I'm worried about her. I'm worried. She's 98 and she's,
And your granddad, he got the vaccine?
He successfully got the vaccine 3 weeks ago and he's getting his second dose this Friday coming, please God.
Well, he actually went to the GP surgery.
He's went, he's mobile. He's able to go down. My grandmother is bang centre in Navantown in Geneve and she's on the doorstep of a hospital. She's right next door to a chemist and she's a stone's throw away from her doctor. But because she's not mobile, she has yet to receive her vaccine. Yeah.
And is there a plan?
There's no plan. There's debates within our family to even draw attention to it. And as I said, I've tried to reach out to TDs just to see if there's any resolution or if there's any exception that could be made. And I have, obviously I've had no reply. So as a last ditch attempt, I said I'd, it was my other half's mother that said, oh, you should contact Joe Duffy. You never know what could happen or who might hear me.
Well, your nanny is 98. Say there,
Leah. She's 98. Yeah. She's an amazing woman. They're married 70 years together.
Wow.
And like so many other people, I know we're all missing our loved ones, but time is so precious. And she never gives out, Joe. Like, she never. She'd be mortified. I was talking to her this morning, and I was like, I'm doing all that I can. And she's like, oh, don't be making a fuss. She goes, I'll ring the doctors today, and I'll see. And, like, I know ringing the doctors is not going to do anything because of the logistics of the vaccine. I'm trying to get information of when the next, the Johnson vaccine, if I'm correct in saying that, is coming in, but... You know, I'm not getting any answers. I don't know if anyone has any answers.
Well, you're entitled to ask the question and raise the issue. Leah, stay with us. Leah Cooney. Liam, your mom is 93. Your father. And you're his sole carer.
I am indeed, and I'm in the same situation as the first caller there. I look after my dad on a full-time basis, 7 days a week. And my dad was due to get the vaccine. He's 93, and all the paperwork was in place before the vaccine was actually rolled out. And when it wasn't forthcoming, I contacted the GP, and they decided, instead of putting him at risk by bringing him into the GP surgery, that they were going to allocate it to the HSC domiciliary care team. So then when I rang the HSC helpline, they said, we don't actually have a date. And I said, do you have a team set up? And they said, no. Unfortunately, as I said, we don't know what we're going to do about the people who are housebound. And it's a sad situation because he is at risk, but he would be able to go to a doctor's surgery. But because that doctor has made the decision, he's now on this list. And there's no sort of answer forthcoming as to when it's going to happen. I'm here 7 days a week. I go out shopping and stuff. So every time I come in, I'm nervous that I'm actually going to put him at risk. And if he does get the injection in 6 weeks' time, that'll put him 8 weeks behind everyone else, and then he'll be waiting another 4 weeks. So I'm just ringing to raise awareness and not criticising anyone. The GP is doing a wonderful service, but this man worked 6.5 days a week as a healthcare professional. He did on call when he came home on Sundays and Christmas Day and everything. It's very sad to see him left in this situation. And,
and the GP decided, Liam, that he didn't want to risk your dad. He didn't want to put your dad under additional risk by bringing him to the surgery. That was his benign intention, yeah.
Yeah, a wonderful GP, and had good intentions, and said, you know something, he met with his with the planning team there in the surgery, and they said, let's get him the domiciliary care team to go out to the house. And he has health conditions which would make it difficult enough for him to go in, but he could manage it. But so when I rang the HSC team, they said, we're really sorry, there's nothing in place for anyone who has to get an injection at home. And I said, what about the carers? And they said, oh, no, absolutely. We don't have anything on those yet. So just a little bit worrying, and instead of letting it go by, it's time to put up a flag now and say something is seriously wrong here.
Okay. And it's we were told it's a supply, but there are so many different calls we're getting at this stage, right throughout last week and indeed before, about people who've been promised a vaccine in the particular age cohort, and it's not happening now. We have the overall we have the overall numbers from the HSE, but.
It's not, no. And as I said, he had all his... We got the paperwork well in advance, the consent forms, and that was all sent in. And when I didn't get a call from the GP surgery, I rang them and they said, oh, no, we've actually allocated it to the HSC. And immediately alarm bells rang. So the fact that I have also work, if you know, the carer doesn't have it, what chance is the, if I'm going out to the general population to do shopping and stuff, I'm putting them at immediate risk when I come back. So it's an unfortunate situation. No blame on anyone, but powerful work being done by the GPs and the nurses, but this is a very, very sensitive area and it needs to be addressed quickly.
Okay, well said. Okay, that's Liam and indeed Leah Cooney. Thank you. Thanks, both.
Joe
at rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
And Joe at rte.ie. And another awful crime. But in this case, the culprit was caught by the Gardaí. Marmion was never even reported to the Gardaí, as far as we know, by the Jesuits. But Seamus Troy, people who know you, Seamus, people might remember you won two under-21 hurling medals for Tip in 89 and 91. Seamus, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Well, how are you, more importantly? I'm very conscious, given the trauma that you've been through, and you want to raise the issue of how the lenient sentence, as you see it, of the man who savagely attacked you. But you were in Cork and you were for a hospital appointment, and it happened after the hospital appointment.
No, I had an operation in Cork.
You had an operation, okay.
In Cork, and I left Cork Regional Hospital and to get the bus home.
Okay.
And next thing, I went around to the bus station and the security guy told me to go around the back. The gentleman that assaulted me grabbed my bag. I pulled my phone out. Mm-hmm. 3999, and next thing he came back, he grabbed my crutch and he beat me 40 times over the head.
My God.
And I got 27 staples in my head, broken eye socket, broken nose, and a broken bone in my neck, and he put three coins down my throat.
He put what down your throat?
Three coins.
You put three coins down your...
down my throat.
And Seamus, what? This is completely unprovoked.
Never met the person in my life, yeah. Martin.
And what did you think was happening? Were you in shock when this man started beating you senseless with your
I
own...
I looked up to him and I said to him, I have kids. And he just said to me, I don't care what you have. I want money. So he took my wallet, took my mobile phone. He broke the crutch off me, only for a member of the public. Mm-hmm. Came down and saw what happened. He ran. But there was a warrant out for his arrest at the time.
So Seamus, you're now, unfortunately, have been savagely beaten. And What did he say when he was putting the coins down your throat?
Yeah, and just said, swallow
them. And what was he?
He's in my back.
Yeah.
And he opened my mouth.
Yeah.
And next thing, he started to beat me again with crutch. And when the Gardaí arrived, they thought it was a murder scene to a Kenta, because the amount of blood I lost.
And was he caught by the guard straight away?
He was caught 25 minutes later with my blood on his jeans and he having the crutch in his hand, my wallet and my bag.
And you say that when the guard arrived, they thought it was a murder scene. Did you think you were going to die?
I thought I was dead because I was unconscious. And the leniency of the sentence was unreal.
And what did this man get?
He got 7 years, 2 years suspended, but he'll do 2 years.
How do you work out that he'll do 2 years?
I was talking to the detective in charge and the DPP, and that's what he'll do because he's in custody since last May.
Ah, okay. So you reckon he'll be out in 2022-23?
Yes, 2022 October.
And did you see this man in court, Seamus?
No. I went allowed to go to the court. And I met two ladies in Cork that took my impact statement.
Yeah.
And my son's impact statement. And my son went to the Garda station the following day because he came to Cork to see me. Mm. And he asked the nurse, "Where's my dad?" And she pointed there, and he said, "That's not my dad." He couldn't recognise me.
So this man, when he came up to you, would have known, obviously you were on a crutch, you're out having an operation. How do you, as someone who's been on crutches before, the most awkward thing, were you carrying a bag, Seamus? How were you managing?
I had a bag on the front of the crutch.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorted.
So he knew how vulnerable you were?
Yeah.
But then he actually used the crutch to...
He broke the crutch off my head.
This is the metal crutch as we know them.
Yeah.
And Seamus, do you remember coming too?
I remember the following day when detectives came to me and asked me, did I know the gentleman in question and made a statement and asked me, could I get my blood samples? And I said, yes, you can. So there was no drugs in my system, no alcohol in my system, God, nothing.
And Adam Sheen pleaded guilty.
Yeah, he did. Because he said he was on drugs.
How long were you in hospital for?
Altogether 9 weeks.
Good God. And you're still suffering, obviously.
Oh, yeah, I went for an operation for my neck for the C2 and 3 of the vertebrae.
Yeah. And what about mentally, Seamus?
I suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder.
And you say your son didn't recognise you, such was the horror of the attack on you.
Oh, and my daughter, Nicole, came in and said, that's not my dad. Because my face was so swollen, my eyes were closed. So they were.
But the Gardaí had him in custody quickly, did he? Did he admit it that? What did you could hardly. Did he admit it early on that there was an issue?
There was no issue.
No, did he admit? Did he admit earlier on that he was guilty of the savage attack on you?
Oh, he did. Yeah.
He admitted that from the get go. Okay.
Yeah.
And he never explained. Insofar as it could be, his explanation was I was on drugs.
Yes.
That was his whole explanation.
Yeah.
And what about you leaving the house? Are you able to leave the house independently, Seamus?
No. I don't leave the house at all.
And what was the maximum sentence available to the court for this man?
10 years. 10 years.
And did the Gardaí, given the horror of this attack on you, Seamus, as you've outlined, the savagery of it, the beating you non-stop with your own crutch to the point where the crutch actually snapped and broke. Trying to force coins. I've never heard of that before. What was the... Trying to force you to swallow coins.
Oh, I swallowed the coins. I had to have an operation and to have them removed.
What type of lunatic was that man?
But sure, that's why I'm trying to get it out. You know, victim's out there and he's out in 2 years and who's next victim?
By the way, by any chance, was he out on bail for something else?
He was out, there was a warrant out for his arrest and the Gardaí couldn't find him.
And he happened upon you?
Yeah.
Completely randomly. Saw this vulnerable man on crutches. Said, give me money or whatever. And then when you couldn't give money, he then attacked you.
No, he took my money.
He took your money. Okay.
So he did. Took my shoes. Dragged me up the road on my jeans. Took my jacket. And as I said, the Gardaí cordoned off the whole place. Thought it was a murder scene to begin with the amount of blood. And only for the gentleman that came down and helped me, he ran then. But the Gardaí caught him 25 minutes later. It was on CCTV.
And is the reason you haven't seen him, is that because of the COVID and the court case, or...?
No, the Detective Sergeant Patrick White. Mm-hmm. Now, he's been good, but he said there was no reason to come to court because...
Okay, he didn't want to put you through.
Yeah, he said that he was going through video link in the court.
Yeah, I understand that. And did your sons ever see him?
No.
So what are you calling, like, the court sentence was relatively recently?
The 5th of February.
Are you calling on the DPP to review the sentence?
I've contacted the DPP and I've contacted the Gardaí and they're not reviewing it.
Well, it's very important that you, and I do appreciate you trying to publicise it this way, Seamus, because the more people know about this man. And did you ever hear anything from him or Adam Sheen's family? Or
not a thing. And I've contacted TDs in Tipperary and everything, and I got no response from him.
And what support are you getting now, Seamus?
None whatsoever.
You're still attending hospital?
Yes.
You've had a number of operations, obviously, as you've outlined.
Yeah.
Are you receiving any counselling?
No, none whatsoever.
And do you think you could benefit from counselling?
Yes, I do.
You do, yeah. And who are you relying on for support? Your family or...?
Just my family. And so my mother, she's 84. Yeah. You know... She's going through it too as well. So it was a tough year.
And I'm just thinking, Seamus, given your sporting prowess, what this man did to you was nothing short of monstrous.
That's just horrific. And I don't want to see anyone going through it.
And did you ever find... Did you ever find out who that gentleman was who came along?
Oh, yeah, I did, yeah.
Oh, great, OK.
Yeah.
Because he came to try and help you.
Yeah.
I presume... Was it mainly around your face the damage was done, given the...
My face, my neck, and just the three coins they put on my... throat.
But if somebody is... That's attempted murder, surely.
It should have been. But he was charged with Section 4.
He beats you round the head 40 times with a crutch.
Yeah.
Drags you along the ground. You're obviously vulnerable. The crutch wasn't there as an ornament. You just had an operation. He then forces you to swallow three coins.
Yeah.
What's the intent of trying to make someone you've already beaten to a pulp swallow three foreign objects? Just to choke them or something? What's...
Maybe, as I said, he had 20 previous convictions for arson, burglary and... possession of a knife.
And have you looked for support, Seamus? Have you asked for...
I've asked the Gardaí in the to gather investigations and everything for help. And they said there's no help out there.
And do you think you will have long-term effects? You already have awful.
Oh, I will, yeah.
Yeah, do you? And how do you manage sleep-wise? And
I don't sleep at all.
Oh, for God's sake.
Even my son will tell you, at nights, I'll be lying up here and put my hands on my head.
And is that with the pain or the trauma, Seamus?
Yeah. I never had to wear glasses before, but now I do, over the tech.
And I'm looking at the photograph here of your face, if you don't mind me looking at it.
Yeah.
After the attack. Mother of good God. No wonder your children couldn't recognise you. No wonder.
It's horrific. As I said, if you have 4 pints in the morning, you get longer off the road.
And then, you see, I'm very conscious of how powerful you're speaking today, Seamus, but it shouldn't fall on you, given what you've been through, to have to campaign publicly like this for whoever the powers that be to look again, which they're entitled to do, to look again at the sentence. Now, it might be decided upon, it might be left as is, but for people to be aware of the long-term, one, the horrific trauma and the pain. I don't know, what do you remember of the pain, Seamus?
As I told you, I was unconscious after he beat me, and I didn't wake up the following day. And
as you say, you thought you were dead.
Yeah.
Okay. I say
and I said,
yeah.
Thanks to the gentleman that came to help me. Yeah. And I appreciate the help from the two ladies that took my impact statement.
I'd say when all this was, well, it'll never be over, as you say, in terms of one, operations, and two, the trauma.
No.
But where are you? Angry? Are you resigned? Are you just hurt mentally and physically?
I'm angry of the law, and I am hurt.
Imagine.
And my kids are too.
Yeah, I can't imagine. What age are your boys? Do you say your boys?
He's 24.
The same age as this fella. Well, he's 26, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's old, isn't he?
He's 24. Nicole is 21. Yeah. Carol is 14.
I can't imagine they're upset for their dad.
Yeah. No, I don't know. Yeah. I just think the law needs to be looked at.
Yeah.
As I said, I contacted TDs in Tipperary and I got no reply.
I hate saying this way. Given the savagery of the attack around the head, I presume he broke your teeth, did he?
He broke three teeth.
Oh, it's just unending. It's just unending. Mm.
Yeah.
And how do you feel talking about it, Seamus, today? Is it fair?
I just want to get the story out there for other people.
Okay, you want to, okay.
Do you know?
Okay.
And I want to try and get the DPP to get it back into court again.
Yeah.
But he won't.
And why can't we get you into the system in terms of counselling and
I've tried my best, but there's no counselling there.
And the operation you were in hospital for, which necessitated you going on crutches, which was the vulnerability that your man spotted and then not just spotted but horrifically used to injure you. Had you been very? Was that operation of a serious nature, Seamus? Can I ask?
Yeah, it was.
Okay. Oh, you've been through such. You've been. Yeah, no, it's wrong to say you've been through because you're obviously going through an awful lot, Seamus. You really are.
For the bad year 2020. And the sentence that he got on the 5th of February was worse.
How did you feel when you heard about the sentence? I know you're angry.
A joke. Absolute joke.
Okay.
It's not.
And you said this man had many previous convictions.
20.
And was assault in there, Seamus?
Assault.
Arson.
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 Possession of a knife and burglary.
Did any of his family ever contact your family to say where?
No, okay. Never did.
Okay. Seamus, thanks indeed. I don't know whether you wish us or you will allow us. I did have to go with a health warning. The wonderful photograph of you on your crutches. And then the photograph of you after this man attacked you, they're just beyond belief.
There's no justice.
Yeah. So many texts in, one remembering your sporting prowess, Seamus, and also so many people wishing you well.
Thanks very much.
Okay. That's Seamus Troy, and as you heard, with the crew upstairs will decide in conjunction with Seamus what he wants to do with this campaign in terms of publicising it. But Seamus, thanks indeed. That's Seamus Troy. Joe at RTE.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
It's not International Women's Day that inspired Gerry Keenan to contact us, but the fact that his sister, Imelda, if she was alive, which she's not, would have been. Well, what is the occasion next, the week after next, Gerry?
Good afternoon, Joe. Hello. How are you?
Good, thanks.
The occasion is Imelda will be turning 50 years of age on the 23rd of March, and I just cannot believe it, where those 27 years that she's missing has gone, you know?
So she was 22.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah. Well, tell us what happened.
Well, I live in Waterford, and we're from County Leash. We're from Mount Melick, County Leash, mm-hmm. originally. And I lived in Waterford most of my life, and I brought Melda down here in the late 80s, in 89. She couldn't believe that Waterford was such a nice place, and just out the road we have Tremor and beautiful scenery, as you know.
Yeah.
But, I got her going to school then for the last year of her education, and she went to the Mercy Convent here in Waterford. And then, all of a sudden, then she done a little course out in Anko, which became false after that, and she was doing a computer course at the time, which computers weren't really streamlined at the time.
Okay.
And didn't really come until the following year, but she was very interested in computers. And then, like every other 16 or 17-year-old, you meet someone and fall in love.
And that's what happens.
Well, yeah, her and her boyfriend set up home in a little apartment in William Street here in Waterford. It's just behind the Tower Hotel. And her boyfriend reported her missing on the 4th of January, 1994.
And no trace has ever been found?
No trace, Joe, no. We've got a lot of calls that were completely invaded, you know, they invaded, but nothing really concrete.
And there was a massive search for Imelda.
Yeah, at the time, I brought down family from Mount Melick and surrounding areas. All our friends and family came down, plus the Leash Civil Defence came on board, the car that's so back away down the river, and everything was going through our heads. As in, can you realise that was a very emotional time for us?
Mm.
But yeah, we done about 10-day search non-stop in Waterford, in Tremor, up around Carrigan Shore in the wooded area, and you know, just our hearts were broken, like, you know. And here we are 27 years after, our hearts are still broken, you know.
And then the milestones in those 27 years, I presume. Is there many in family? What has happened in terms of family life? And
yeah, there was 9 siblings altogether. Five boys and four girls. Imelda, of course, will be the youngest girl. But then there's the youngest boy also. But since then, my mother has passed, and two of my brothers have passed also. Mm. And I can swear that they went to their own graves with broken hearts.
And not knowing, just the not, well, the fact, I mean, in terms of your own conversation now, Jerry, do you refer to Melda as having passed, even though you don't know what happened?
Believe it or not, Joe, I don't, you know, and just, okay. I think this keeps me going, you know.
Yeah.
We are a very close-knit family, you know, and I've always thought at the back of my head, and either a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel, like, there's nothing out there really that can prove to me that she's dead, so I'm not giving up on that. There's okay. nothing much out there to tell me that she's alive, and this is where I'm in limbo, and the Keenan family are in limbo for the last 27 years, but I have to mention that I attend family support meetings. I have met a lot of people that are in the same boat as we are down to the years, and there's a good friend of mine, Dermot Brown from Mullingar. He chairs this meeting for us. Mm-hmm. And the comfort that we get out of these meetings is just unbelievable.
Are other families of missing, invariably women, but missing people who've no sight or sound.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and all people are in the same boat as we are. We sit down in a small room where you have about 8, maybe 10 families. We're getting to know each other more. Closer than anybody else, and we always attend the National Missing Persons Day, where you're talking about 400 people gathering in one room, and to look at the frown on everyone's face to think that their loved ones aren't coming back after all these years, you know.
And as you say, it's a family support group, support being the important word.
Exactly, yeah.
And are the Gardaí still involved in
Gardaí and Watford, the case is still open, it's still activated. I have two liaison officers who I'm in contact with regularly.
Okay.
They do come up to my apartment. I go back down to the barracks if I feel that I have a very bad day, which I have a couple of bad days, and I have a lot of sleepless nights, as the family do also. But we just have to continue on to get her back in the spotlight, to let her know that this young girl that went missing in Waterford and from County Leash is still a missing person, you know.
And Imelda was only 22. Where was she working at the time again?
Well, she was doing a FOSS course.
Oh, brilliant,
okay. Out in the industrial estate, and she was mad into computers, you know.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, that if this happened today or last week, you can imagine if you walk down the quay in Waterford or any street in Dublin, there's CCTV everywhere, so someone, you know, would pick up on it very quick, like, you know. But unfortunately, these weren't the subject, and these weren't available in 1994, you know.
Yeah. And I know on the Garda.ie website, they've done, with the help of computers, they've tried to create an image of Imelda as she would be now.
I could not imagine Imelda. I mean, the last time I saw Imelda was at her wedding in 1992.
Yeah.
And that was 2 years previous before she went missing. And I couldn't imagine Imelda, like, at 30 years of age, or 40, and now here we come around to her 50th birthday. And I would love to think that if she was still alive and had kids, and, you know, and I'd see her little kids running around the place, and she was still only in her prime at 50 years of age, but to be missing 27 years of her life, it's a heartbreaking for the Keenan family, I'm telling you.
But you're not going to let up. That's your point, Jerry. That's where you're using, as you think about her every minute of every day. But when it struck you that she would have been 50 on the 23rd of this month.
That's correct.
You said that should be remarked upon and used as a hopefully to.
Yeah, we have a beautiful plaque erected down in William Street where she went missing. And I pass that every day. I'm out walking every day, and I stop there for about 5 minutes and sit down and maybe have a little cry to myself, and but definitely say a few prayers, and hopefully that something will come out of it, and that someone will contact her, you know. But at the back of my head, I think there's maybe two or three people in Morford that are holding back vital information from us, and they had to let go because, you know, our pain cannot continue.
It's pain,
you know, it's just... It just you can't put a plaster on it and tomorrow it'll be okay. It just doesn't happen that way, you know. And people, I heard people talking on the radio that they're in lockdown for the last 12 months. I mean, we're in lockdown 27 years.
Yeah.
And it's just a heartbreaking situation to go through. I would not wish this on my worst enemy, you know.
Okay. So strongly put, Gerry, so strongly put.
Yeah, yeah.
And think, do you pray for Imelda? How do you...
I pray, Joe, yeah. I go down now, when I drop the phone now, I'll be heading off for my little walk, and I will, as I said, stand at the plaque and I'll say a few prayers. Now, this is not only on a Monday. It'll happen again on Tuesday and Wednesday.
I know.
Any time I feel like that, I pray, and I just pray that God might give me an answer. And as I said here, I think my mother and my two brothers went to their grave without getting an answer, and definitely they went with broken hearts.
Well, I think a lot of listeners, Gerry, today will be joining you in those prayers for dear Imelda.
Yeah.
And hopefully, as you say, there's some people out there who have information. So,
yeah, we don't want... the Keenan family never look for revenge. We're not a bitter family. We're looking for an answer. We're looking for... If I just found, and someone told me that there was a bag of bones found where Imelda's, I gather them up and bring them home and give her a Christian burial with my parents in Mount Melick, and be delighted then to visit the grave. But the nearest place I have to a grave at the moment, of course, is that lovely, beautiful plaque down in William Street here in Waterford, right behind the Tower Hotel.
Okay. Gerry Keenan, thanks indeed. And
thank you, Joe. And
hopefully other people will
hopefully
be...
I would love it if I didn't have this conversation, but, you know, it's heartbreaking, really, for myself and the family, you know.
Okay, go safely now, Gerry, and
thank
look after yourself. You're a great, great man.
Cheers.
You're a great man for remembering and insisting that your sister is still alive, and that if it's otherwise, somebody should come forward and reveal. 1850 715 815.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Before I go to another two remarkable women on International Women's Day, and Inga has a very difficult story to tell, let me give you three women to think of today. One is Denise Woods, who's a great writer. And just three writers I came across recently. She writes novels. She also writes as Denise Devlin. Overnight to Innsbruck is one of the books I read. The other two are current releases. One is Megan Nolan, Megan from Waterford, where Gerry was talking about there. Megan Nolan has written an incredible novel. I read it as a memoir about 2 months ago, and I couldn't get over it. It's called Acts of Desperation. Really, really very unusual. It's going to be a classic of its type. And then the other book, again, I've been tweeting about this book for the last 8 weeks, I think, when I came across it accidentally, is by Zoe Holohan. She was on The Late Late Show, and she's been on a number of radio programmes over the weekend, As the Smoke Clears. And it's the true story of what happened, Zoe, on her honeymoon, and the death in those awful Greek wildfires in 2018, the death of her husband, Brian. It's a remarkable story, a horrific, grieving story. But the telling of it and what Zoe has gone through, this book will stay with you for a long, long, long time afterwards. And the resilience and fortitude of Zoe will stay with you as well. Just wanted to mention that on the day that's in it. And now to go to that difficult story, Inga, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Then tell us, it happened in the shop. What happened?
I had a very ugly day. On Thursday.
Okay.
I was in a shop with my daughter.
Yes.
My daughter is 9.
Okay.
She is born with Down syndrome.
Okay.
In the store, I was looking for products. I kept my daughter close to me.
Yes.
We did our shopping. And obviously, I got distracted by something. I don't know what exactly distracted me. I just, you know, turned around, and my daughter wasn't here with me anymore.
Okay.
So I started to shout her name and, you know, look for her. And one shopper came by, and my daughter was coming, and that shopper said my daughter hit a kid, a girl. Obviously, I didn't see an accident. I was told that my daughter hit a girl into face 3 times.
Okay.
And of course, my daughter was coming first. That little girl was coming behind her. I grabbed my daughter by hand and I, you know, I just stopped that little girl and I said, I'm very sorry. Yeah. I couldn't say anymore, you know.
Yeah, what else could you do? That's, you said you were sorry.
I said, I'm really very sorry. And I said to my daughter, I grabbed by hand my daughter and I say, apologize now. Apologize, say you're sorry. And my daughter just was staring because she kind of non-verbal that much,
gosh,
you know.
No, okay. And yeah, then
she was
then
standing and staring.
And then there was a remark made. I'm over time, but then there was a remark made about your beautiful daughter, which was awful.
And then the father came in, that girl's father.
Yeah.
And obviously, that little girl was crying. He found out about what has happened, and I said to father, "Look, I'm really sorry. I can't control it. I wanted to explain somehow.
Okay.
But he wouldn't listen. He turned away and he just walked. But then after a minute, he returned to me and he said, "Look, I'm not happy about this. You know," he started shouting at me. He became very aggressive.
Okay.
I mean, he basically verbally assaulted me.
Oh.
He said, "Keep your child on the leash."
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Inga, I'm sorry I'm over time. Apologies, but I know you wanted to tell that story and hopefully you will remind people to be extra sensitive. Thanks indeed, Inga. Today's programme was produced by one of the small group of remarkable women that have run this programme and have been running it every single day since this pandemic began over a year ago. Every single day. And today's woman at the helm again is Lisa Marie Berry. Our series producer is Rebecca Meehan. There's Sean O'Gorman. There's Maeve Mooney. We have an incredible, incredible team and Annette Egan as well. And Fergus also is up there. With myself, but an incredible group of women. We are really, really privileged to have them in RTE. Back tomorrow, 1:45. Ray Darcy's next.